Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 13th of October, these are our main stories. Kurdish-led forces in northern Syria say the United States has a moral obligation to protect them from a Turkish assault now in its fourth day. The president of Ecuador, Lenin Moreno, has announced a military-enforced curfew in the capital, Quito, and surrounding areas after days of violent protests over his austerity plan. And Islamist militias have carried out two attacks in Africa. At least 16 people were killed at a mosque in Burkina Faso. Also in this podcast.
I'm Richard Hamilton and I'm walking outside the newsroom studios in the pouring rain in order to reveal some very surprising but groundbreaking scientific research.
And we'll have more details on that later on. Kurdish forces fighting a Turkish offensive in northern Syria have said that the United States has a moral obligation to help them. Redo Khalil is from the Syrian Democratic Front.
Our allies guaranteed us protection, but they abandoned us without warning and decided unjustly to withdraw their troops from the Turkish border. We call on our allies to fulfill their moral obligations.
The Kurds also urged the US to close the region's airspace to Turkish warplanes. They accused the Americans of having abandoned them in spite of previous promises of protection. In Cairo, an emergency meeting of the Arab League has condemned the Turkish operation. The organization's Secretary General Ahmed Abul Gate said the Turkish invasion of Syria violated international law.
It only has one name, which is invasion and aggression. An invasion of the land of an Arab country and an aggression on its sovereignty. It is a condemned invasion which must not be overlooked in the world. No matter the pretext given by the invader, the aggression remains an aggression. One that is refused, condemned, standing outside the legitimacies and rules of international law.
Thousands of Kurdish troops died fighting alongside the Americans as they uprooted the Islamic State group. But the Kurds say that what remains of IS is now taking advantage of the turmoil caused by the Turkish offensive and reactivating its sleeper cells. The Syrian border city of Ras al Ain is currently a main battleground, where pro-Turkish fighters at one stage claimed to have taken control. The Kurds there say they are counter-attacking effectively. The BBC's Martin Patience is in the nearby Turkish border town of Akçakale.
What we know is that pro-Turkish fighters are inside that town. We know that there's been fierce clashes. I saw one video which was sent to us. A pro-Turkish fighter said they'd taken the city and then almost immediately he came under fire from Kurdish fighters. So there is fierce resistance. I don't think it will be clear until tomorrow exactly whose control it is under. But the point is, this is only a matter of time. The Kurdish forces in that town are simply no match for the might of Turkey, which, let's not forget, is a NATO power.
It's a hard battle, isn't it? And the Kurds are prepared to put up lots of resistance.
They are certainly putting up resistance. And I spoke to one fighter a day or so ago, and he said the Kurds are putting up stiffer resistance than I think many expected. I think there was perhaps suggestions that Kurdish fighters would simply melt away. But it looks like they are perhaps buying time. They know that the longer this offensive goes on, then it's likely that the international outcry will grow. And in fact, the Kurdish-dominated Syrian Democratic Forces had a press conference today, and they emphasised, underlined the fact that they believe they've been stabbed in the back by America, and they called on the international community to do more. Now, until now, those calls have fallen on deaf ears, but there is a growing backlash in Washington.
The humanitarian situation could very soon be dire. So many people on the move.
It is extraordinary. More than 100,000 people, with estimates of up to 500,000. this is a huge offensive across a huge area of territory, and many people are fleeing as soon as they get the opportunity. But it's always interesting in Syria. People often hold out to the last minute because they realise if they leave their homes, then they might never go back. So obviously they're reluctant to do that. And then, of course, wherever they end up, they might not have assistance. I've spoken to one woman. She said she'd known that for her babies and her entire family, 20 members of it, including her grandparents, were forced to sleep out in the open.
And I'm going to talk with another guest in a moment about the situation with IS fighters who were imprisoned by the Kurds. What exactly is the risk here?
It's a huge risk. We've already seen five Islamic State fighters escape from prison. And the Kurds have made it clear, look, if we're fighting the Turkish military, we can't look after thousands of IS prisoners. Until now, they are doing that. But as the fight intensifies, they will pull away fighters from the prisons and move them to the front line. And what that does is it increases the likelihood of a prison break. IS have done it in the past, and many think they could do it again.
That was Martin Patience talking to Paul Henley. France has suspended all weapons exports to its NATO ally Turkey in response to the offensive against Kurdish forces. A statement from the Foreign and Defence Ministries said the measure would begin immediately. Germany earlier announced that it was reducing its arms sales to Ankara. Liz Sly is a journalist for The Washington Post based in Beirut. Paul Henley asked her whether she thought there was a real risk of an IS resurgence in northern Syria.
There is a chance of an IS resurgence because they haven't yet finished getting rid of the last vestiges of the Islamic State. The territorial caliphate was defeated in March. They don't hold territory anymore, but a lot of fighters scattered after that battle. Some of them scattered across the border to Iraq. Some of them scattered to communities inside Syria, in eastern Syria, mostly in the province of Deir ez-Zor, but elsewhere as well, where they have families, communities that they are from, and they're actively trying to reorganize, to reestablish the networks they used to have. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is alive, and any vacuum, any sort of let up in the operations against them brings a real risk that they will reorganize, perhaps not right away, but maybe 6 months, a year from now, something like that.
How could they escape? Literally, because their prison guards have fled the scene?
Well, I'm talking about not just the danger of a prison release. I'm talking about ISIS sleeper cells, ISIS remnants, ISIS sympathizers who were there in the communities, who didn't get captured because the end battle was very messy. And yes, they can certainly reactivate and reorganize and come back as a group, even if the prisoners don't escape. But there's also a risk of the prison escape, more likely, I would say, just because of a security vacuum, a big defeat on the YPG, a big defeat on the SDF, the coalition they were with, and general chaos and people getting away.
Liz Sly, a journalist for The Washington Post based in Beirut. Suspected jihadists have attacked a mosque in the north of Burkina Faso, close to the border with Mali, killing at least 16 people. A week ago, Islamist militants killed 20 people at a gold mine in the neighbouring Soum province. Aid agencies have been warning about a rapidly deteriorating humanitarian situation as the attacks have become increasingly common. Our Africa regional editor Will Ross reports.
The gunman targeted the mosque in the remote village of Salmossi as people were praying. The attack, which is thought to have been carried out by jihadists, prompted people to flee the village in Oudalan province close to the Malian border. As a sign of growing anger over the insecurity, a few hours ago about 1,000 people took to the streets of the capital Ouagadougou to denounce the violence and the presence of foreign military forces in the region. The UN Refugee Agency says over the last 3 months, more than 250,000 people in Burkina Faso have been forced to flee their homes.
That was Will Ross. And reports from Kenya say at least 10 police officers have been killed when their vehicle struck a roadside bomb close to the border with Somalia. The authorities believe the device was planted by the Islamist group Al-Shabaab. It's the second such attack in 4 months. 12 Kenyan police were killed in a border explosion in June. Now to Ecuador. Police firing tear gas as protests continued in the capital Quito for a 10th day. They began over austerity and the end of fuel subsidies. The president, Lenin Moreno, placed the city and surrounding areas under curfew and military control. The group behind the demonstrations has decided to hold talks with the president in what's being seen as the first sign of a potential breakthrough. Matthias Sibel is in Quito and told us more about the situation there.
Indigenous people march again around the city, and there were other kind of things, criminal acts. There were attacks against people, and especially there was an attack against an office of the Justice Department. And this is the second time this office is attacked. That is the reason why the president, Lenin Moreno, who is not in Quito, is still in Guayaquil, decided to extend the curfew. The curfew started every day at 8 p.m. Now it will start at 3 p.m. And the president decided the militarization of the city.
And give us an idea of what sort of effect the curfew is having. Is it calming things down?
The indigenous leaders accepted formally the offering of Moreno to negotiate. So we wake up this day, this Saturday, with some hope that the conflict could finish soon.
And remind us about the roots of this conflict. What is it that the indigenous groups and the government have to talk about? How can they find a common purpose and agreement?
The origin of everything was a decree that, for the first time in 40 years, put an end to the subsidized fuel prices. So, for the first time in four decades, Ecuador will have normal prices when the people go to buy gasoline or buy diesel, and that measure will affect almost everything, because when the price of the fuel rises, everything rises, every price rises. So indigenous people are asking Moreno to take back that decision to leave the prices subsidized, and Moreno is saying he will not take back that measure because it's been 40 years and the Ecuadorian economy is suffering a lot because of that.
That was Matthias Sibel in Ecuador. In a feat of seemingly superhuman endeavour, the runner Eliud Kipchoge has become the first man to complete a marathon in under 2 hours. He made it to the finish line in Vienna in 1 hour, 59 minutes and 40 seconds. The reigning Olympic champion, who also holds the official marathon record, was cheered on by huge crowds around a specially designed course in the Austrian capital. It won't be recognised as a world record because the specially staged event broke the rules on the amount of help a runner can be given. Our correspondent Adi Adedoyin reports.
The last time Eliud Kipchoge attempted to run the marathon in under 2 hours, he finished just 26 seconds outside. This time, there was no mistake.
Eliud Kipchoge storms into the history books in Vienna, the first man to run a marathon in under 2 hours. One final lung-busting stride for Kipchoge, one giant leap for human endeavour.
He beats the mark by 20 seconds, cheered on by a large crowd in the Austrian capital. He was embraced by his wife Grace at the finishing line, then mobbed by his pacemakers, including many of the world's best middle and long-distance runners. This is a moment in history, but it won't be ratified as a world record because it wasn't in open competition and involved rotating pacemakers. Kipchoge was also accompanied by a car which shone a light on the road to mark where he and the pacemakers had to be if they were to stay on track to beat the two-hour mark. But the Olympic and world record holder said afterwards this wasn't about records.
After Roger Panister met yesterday in 1954, it took another 63 years. I tried and I did not get. Now it's 65 years. I have tried. I'm the happiest man to run under 2 hours in order to inspire many people, to tell people that no human is limited.
This was one of the last great symbolic barriers in athletics. Eliud Kipchoge says he hopes today's achievement will encourage others to believe they can break the two-hour mark.
That was Adi Adedoyin. In recent weeks, Saudi Arabia has dramatically improved access for tourists, introducing a simple arrival visa for visitors from 48 countries. The tourism minister says he wants to attract 100 million visitors a year by 2030. And in an effort to make foreign women feel more welcome, the country's even relaxing its notoriously strict rules on modest dress. But are opinions changing among Saudi people too? Georgia Tolley went to find out, and she begins her report in the capital, Riyadh.
Everyone was talking about it at breakfast in the hotel. Not the newly launched visa regime, but the fact that foreign women would no longer be expected to wear the abaya, the traditional robe-like garment which covers a woman from neck to feet. As a group of journalists, we'd flown in on a government-arranged trip for the big launch of Saudi Arabia's tourism sector. Inadvertently, as women, we'd also become the story.
We're just leaving the hotel, and two of the Western journalists with me have decided not to wear their abayas. They say they find them too hot, and they don't like having to cover up. It feels quite risky. The law only changed overnight, and I'm worried that we're going to annoy people by seeming immodest. I'm keeping mine on. So we've just stepped out of the car to take some classic tourist photographs outside a fort. There's a great big green Saudi flag flapping in the wind. And Friday prayers have just finished, so there's plenty of gentlemen flooding out of the mosque. And two of the ladies with me are not covered, they're not wearing abayas. And it's fair to say that not a single gentleman has glanced in their direction. It's caused no ripples whatsoever. Our tour passed smoothly, but then we decided to stop and chat to some of the men buying dates at a street stall. One man gestured angrily at the women with me.
This country is Islamic country, so we should have to respect. If you are in European, in your country, you can as like. This is different from you.
The Minister of Tourism has just said that he doesn't mind if foreign women do not wear abayas.
No, I don't think so. They didn't say like this. There is Islamic country here.
The next day, we left the capital for the seaside city of Jeddah.
In preparation for takeoff, please make sure...
The domestic airport was full of women in black, wearing the niqab, which leaves just their eyes uncovered.
Welcome to the historic city of Jeddah. 1400 years ago, Jeddah became the commercial capital of the Arabian Peninsula.
After the tourist bubble of the hotel, this was traditional and more typical Saudi Arabia, and it felt very different. We caught a lot of curious glances, and it wasn't until we stopped in a souvenir shop that we found someone who represents the changing face of Saudi Arabia.
I moved to work in Jeddah for 3 years.
Rima said she'd come to find us because she'd heard that there were women in the neighbourhood not wearing abayas. I asked her what she thought of the new rule.
When I first heard it, I didn't feel really happy because I thought that it doesn't impact local as well. But then I realized that with time, it will impact us as locals. And honestly, for the past 2 years, I've been trying not to wear real abayas when the Crown Prince said that we are as locals are free to wear modest clothing.
Last year, the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, said that Sharia or Islamic laws do not require women to wear an abaya or headscarf, just decent and respectful clothing. This move was seen as further evidence of customs changing in the kingdom. Only 2 years ago, the Mutawa, or religious police, could arrest women for failing to cover their hair. This Jeddah supermarket worker agrees that times are changing.
Even Saudi women, we are not forced to wear it, but it is not acceptable. Now, when you walk on the beach, some women don't wear abayas. They wear jackets and stuff, which is very nice. In normal days, I wear colorful abayas, but here in work, we should wear black abayas.
That report was by Georgia Tolley in Saudi Arabia. Now for news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
Dr. Ruja promised to make the world rich.
We create the world around this coin.
Her company made billions from global investors.
She called herself the crypto queen.
And then, 2 years ago, she disappeared.
How can this happen?
Join me, Jamie Bartlett, as I search for Dr. Ruja and the truth about her company, OneCoin.
Kidnapping, killing.
It starts to get very scary, very, very fast.
The Missing Crypto Queen. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Now to Japan. The biggest storm to hit the country in decades is causing damage and disruption with high winds and heavy rain. Millions of people were advised to seek shelter away from their homes. Rivers in the capital, Tokyo, are overflowing. Thousands of people there live below sea level. Andrew Higgins is an English teacher in Tochigi, north of the capital.
You look outside and you're, oh, it's just raining. And then all of a sudden you just get hit with this giant gust of wind out of nowhere. And kind of forces you back inside. And luckily for me, my house here has typhoon shutters, so I can close those and shut those to get some protection from that wind. But yeah, even with all those closed and you're inside, you still hear it. You still feel it. It's almost like a passing train. Like you just get that rumble and your house shakes and it's very unsettling.
And how ready are local people with those sort of precautions like typhoon shutters? Typhoons are not uncommon in Japan, are they?
A lot of houses do have them, but I've lived in apartments that just didn't have them at all. And so, you know, you just kind of stay away from the windows and kind of hope that, you know, no debris or anything like that breaks under your windows.
Is there a drill that people seem to be used to, stocking up on food, you know, hunkering down?
Yeah, I think it's the typical, you know, go to the grocery store the night before and try to pick up as much, you know, non-perishable stuff as you could. I went out this morning before it actually got here and noticed that there were big holes in different sections of the grocery store. You had the bottled water section was almost all gone, and the cup noodle section was almost all gone. So, you know, certain things that people knew that, you know, if they lost power or lost water, that they could, you know, survive on for a few days.
The real risk here is the volume of water falling, half a meter in 24 hours expected in some areas. There have been warnings, haven't there? Landslides and so on.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think I've counted about 6 or 7 warnings that I got on my phone today alone, which is the most that I've ever had for any type of storm or emergency here in Japan. But yeah, I mean, that's definitely a big concern because that amount of water, the lakes or the rivers are going to fill up very quickly and overflow. And then you've got to deal with the landslides and stuff like that as well. So
there was a small earthquake in Japan on the same day, wasn't there? Tell me more generally about Japanese building to withstand these kind of shocks.
Yeah, I was sitting here and I was thinking, man, the last thing we need is an earthquake in the middle of this typhoon. But Japanese buildings are very well designed to withstand earthquakes. And so if the building's rocking, you know, that's a good sign. It's a little unsettling, but you know that the building's doing what it's supposed to be doing to keep you safe.
That was Andrew Higgins, who is a teacher in Japan, and he was talking to my colleague Paul Henley. As Poland heads to the polls on Sunday to choose a new parliament, the ruling Law and Justice Party is on course for another 4 years in power, if the opinion polls are accurate. But its policies have divided public opinion. From Poland, our Europe correspondent Kevin Connolly reports.
There can't be many governing parties in Europe that share their headquarters building with a medical testing laboratory, a Mongolian restaurant or a billiard hall, let alone all three. Rather surprisingly, Poland's deeply traditional and conservative Law and Justice Party is one of them. In the political bit of the building, Poland's forthcoming parliamentary elections are seen as a major opportunity. Law and Justice, seen by its supporters as reassuringly patriotic and by its detractors as disturbingly authoritarian, wants an outright majority, leaving it free to govern without coalition partners.
Right now, when populism is just another swear word people throw at each other in the political spectrum, I wouldn't use it.
The party's signature economic policy of raising child benefit, pensions and minimum wages could be seen as shameless populism. But its spokesman Radek Fogiel says it's an example of how a country still feeling the hangover of communist dictatorship needs to catch up with Western Europe.
For example, our signature social program, the 500 plus, so the child benefit.
That's 500 zlotys per month per child.
That's true, around £100. It's a novelty here in Poland. But let's be frank, programs like that were introduced in the Western European countries back in the 70s. So it's more like catching up than anything else for me.
To hear the opposition charge sheet against the government and its supporters in more detail, I convened a meeting of the Bobinski family at a restaurant in Warsaw. Chris Bobinski was the distinguished correspondent of the Financial Times here when I was his undistinguished BBC counterpart 30 years ago. His wife, Lena Kolarska-Bobinska, was a government minister for the opposition's Civic Platform Party. Chris feels the rest of Europe hasn't woken up to the scale of what's at stake in Poland.
They are destroying a conventional liberal system with a rule of law, division of powers, etc., etc. And this is something that Poland was building after 1989. And now people of my generation see that this is being dismantled by this government.
As a politician who championed Polish membership of the EU, Lena Kolarska-Bobinska says attitudes towards Brussels are the other crucial front line here.
Poland has completely withdrawn from any international initiatives. It's becoming very close and parochial. We are less and less important in constant conflict with the European Union. We are becoming now on the margin of Europe, which is really painful.
Liberals see the EU as an anchor of democracy. Government voters see it as meddlesome, authoritarian, slow to understand Poland. The billiard hall in the basement of the Law and Justice headquarters was pretty quiet, and we had a quick game on the way out. But on the floors above, the momentum of the parliamentary campaign is building. Law and Justice believes its cocktail of patriotism, low-level friction with Brussels and generous welfare policies is a winning package in Polish politics. Opinion polls suggest they're right, and that it might even deliver an outright parliamentary majority.
That was Kevin Connolly in Poland. Now, here is something that might brighten your day if you are a brisk walker and dampen your spirits if you tend to amble slowly. A new study says that your walking speed when you're in your 40s is a sign of how much your brain has aged. That's to say, slower walkers have older brains. We sent our reporter Richard Hamilton on a walkabout in London in the pouring rain in the name of science.
So I'm walking outside New Broadcasting House, not far away from our studio, and I'm walking quite slowly. This is my natural gait, my natural walking speed. My wife will verify that I'm a quite slow walker, and she's often saying, come on, come on, we're going to be late, we're going to miss our bus or our aeroplane or whatever. And my children also say, Daddy, you're very slow, you need to hurry up a bit. And I'd always thought this was a sign of my sort of natural nonchalant, languid, cool personality, but apparently it's a sign that my brain is aging faster than other people who walk much quicker. So it's a sign of accelerated aging decades before old age. And the study has been carried out by researchers at King's College London and Duke University in North Carolina in the United States. And they looked at 1,000 people in New Zealand who were born in the 1970s. And they also did brain scans and cognitive tests. And those that walked slower had lungs, teeth and immune systems that were in worse shape than the faster walkers. Dr. Lena Rasmussen is a neuroscientist from Duke University, and she's the lead author of this report.
We actually don't know the explanation to this. It's such a remarkable finding that we find that all the way back from age 3 that there is an association between cognitive function and then the speed at which you walk when you're 45 years old. There could be several explanations. Something could be in your genes. Something could be that children who have better cognitive function at age 3 will also have better health behaviors later in life, which will affect their health when they're 45 years old. Or it could be that there are shared structures in the brain responsible for controlling both walking and other cognitive tasks.
The brain scans of the slower walkers also showed that these people were likely to have older-looking brains. That means ones that had got smaller with old age. And they also found that children who would grow up to be the slower walkers were on average 12 points lower on the IQ scale, so they were actually less intelligent. And in terms of what impact this research might have, it means that looking at the walking speeds of younger people could be a way of testing treatments that would slow down the aging process. And they also say it would enable people to make changes to their lifestyle while they're still young and healthy. Now, I'm still walking at this natural pace, but if I'm going to make it on time to report for the programme, I think I better speed up a bit and get back to the studio for the newsroom.
Nonchalant, languid and prematurely elderly Richard Hamilton reporting. A Spanish parachutist was left dangling in front of King Felipe when his canopy snagged on a lamppost as he came into land at the annual National Day parade in Madrid. This report from Mike Sanders.
It was all going so well for Corporal Luis Fernando Pozo of the Parachute Brigade. An appreciative crowd applauded as he descended gracefully to earth, trailing a Spanish flag impeccably unfurled, until his glide was brought to an abrupt halt by the lamp standard. As the corporal pondered his predicament, the applause resumed. King Felipe joined in. The parachutist managed to disentangle the flag, extricate himself from his harness, and shin down the lamppost unaided. Medics checked him over and pronounced him unharmed. While his dignity may have been briefly ruffled, there was an unexpected bonus for him. He got to meet the King and the acting Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez after the parade.
And that was Mike Sanders. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast tomorrow. And don't forget that we still want your questions for our special Brexit Cast Global News Pod mashup, which we will be recording at a date to be confirmed later this month, at some point when we can corral together our experts, Brexperts, can I call them Brexperts? Laura Koonsberg, Katia Adler, Chris Mason and Adam Fleming. Anything that is knowable about Brexit, they know it. The less knowable, they can probably take an educated punt at. Your Brexit-related questions, please. Also, anything else you'd like to share with us, the email address remains globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.